Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and I'm joined today by a writer, blogger, webcomics creator. She's the author of the book Solutions and Other Problems, and the number one New York Times bestseller, Hyperbole and a Half, from the webcomic of the same name. Allie Brosh, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you so much.
So before we get started, I would like to remind all of our listeners that we are currently in the middle of KBOO's all-important fall membership drive. If you donate now through October 31st at kboo.fm/give, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $4,500. Because we're staying safe and trying to get those COVID numbers down, we are not in the station to take your calls right now, but you can show your support by giving online, kboo.fm. KBOO is one of the very last media outlets that still brings you local and independent news, music, and public affairs. We've been doing this here in Portland for over half a century, and this program has been coming to you for nearly 17 years now, inviting important cultural figures into the studio and venturing out to events that might fly beneath the radar of the big media monoliths. So yes, you can support this very special programming today by going online to kboo.fm/give, or if you like, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. So Allie, this book is an epic collection. It's 7 years in the making. Tell us a little bit about your process, how your writing and your art come together. There are 25 chapters in Solutions and Other Problems, and they're mostly self-contained stories, but is there a thread you wanted to make sure was there to hold everything together?
Yeah, I wanted to arrange the chapters in, you know, I wanted them to be able to be read mostly independently of each other. Like, there are some that have continuations in other chapters, but when taken as a whole, I wanted it to sort of tell a story in a less specific way than within the chapter. If you read the whole thing and kind of think about the connections between the chapters, like what the transition might mean, what the juxtaposition might mean, I'm hoping that those parts tell a story.
And how about the title, Solutions and Other Problems?
And other problems. So I'm the type of person who is always trying to fix things, always trying to come up with the solutions for the problems I have. And the issue is that I don't always know how to do that. And so I end up creating more problems. I take the center of mass of the problem and transfer it to a different area. So it feels like progress.
Language is a funny thing. I'm reminded of back in my college days, I encountered a chemistry student who was from South Asia, and he thought the term solution was a very pithy metaphor for what happens with problems. You know, like in organic chemistry, problems...
Yeah, the solution and the precipitate.
Yeah, well, problems go into solution, they come out of solution, they reemerge, they never really go away forever. But when he learned that that's not what we mean, Americans don't think that way, he was a little crestfallen.
That's actually a really cool way of seeing it.
Yeah, we think of solutions as being, okay, it's gone away forever. We've thrown it out with the trash and it'll never come back.
But yeah, I can just come back out of solution into a precipitate again.
So you've compared your stories to stand-up comedy only with pictures. Now, as an introvert, is it hard for you to get up on stage, but much easier to work with the art?
Yes. I really like the feel of stand-up comedy, and I was trying to replicate that without having to actually get up in front of people and talk or to memorize like bits. I would rather work on editing and refining than the process of memorization. And so when I first started writing, I was planning on just writing, not doing the pictures. Art seemed like a separate thing. It didn't seem like a thing that would go with writing to me. But in trying to write comedy, I felt very limited by the lack of that physicality, that presence of the comedian. It's a very important thing, stage presence. You know, if you've watched a video of a stand-up comedian versus just listened to the audio, it's a very different experience. And so I was hoping to find something that would give me the same type of physicality in, you know, on the printed page. or on a, you know, on a blog or webcomic. And so that's how the idea to add pictures got started.
Now, your original plan for being a grown-up was to use your degree in human biological sciences. And you say that when you started the blog, when you started Hyperbole and a Half, that was originally a way of avoiding studying for a physics exam?
Yes, I was taking summer courses at the very tail end of my collegiate career. And I had a physics final coming up and I was putting off studying for it because I do pretty much anything besides what I'm supposed to do. I'm willing to be productive in any direction besides the direction I'm supposed to go. And that is how I started my blog originally. I did end up studying for the final eventually. It just took me a while. But yeah, ended up being a worthwhile detour.
Right. I mean, you are also a competitive runner and the universe kind of took that away from you as well.
Yeah, I was actually trying to run professionally after college. I went to school on a running scholarship and did fairly well throughout college there. And so I actually gave up a job at a lab that I got after college with the hopes that I could run professionally, which is, there's not a lot of money in running, but I was very passionate about it. And it seemed like something I could do that wouldn't require as much of a schedule. I've always been really anti-schedule. I don't like having my time dictated for me. I'm willing to do a lot of work. I'm willing to put in a lot of effort, but having a structure to my time has always seemed, I don't know, unusually unappealing to me. And so I thought that this could be an opportunity to do something where I could structure my own time. And so I was training and I tore a muscle in my calf and couldn't do that anymore. And so suddenly I was stranded in a 3,000 population town in the middle of nowhere, Montana, with nothing to do, and got back into the blog and just used that sort of as a way to distract myself from my misery and impending homelessness. and here I am.
And you grew up in the Mountain West. You've lived in California, Idaho, Colorado, Montana, Oregon, and you've always been surrounded by animals.
Yes.
And in your comics, in your stories, one of your gifts is your talent for drawing expressive animals, dogs, cats, horses. They all have these dynamic poses. And on the other hand, when you're drawing yourself, your style is much more basic, you know, kind of iconic. You've got this one particular avatar that represents you in both of your books.
Yeah. And it looks a bit more like an animal than a person itself. Cause I sort of think of myself like an animal. It's my way of looking at myself that makes me feel more compassionate toward myself. When I can see myself as the weird little alien animal creature that I am, rather than this fancy person with person dignity and person thoughts.
Yeah. It's interesting. You have, I'll mention that Scott McCloud, the author of Understanding Comics. It's a classic text. And Scott McCloud said that the way to make a character relatable to readers is to make the face less detailed, more abstract. So his narrators and protagonists always had simple features. Your narrator character, your stand-in, has this sort of, it's kind of a geometric outfit, a pink dress.
Just a blob. Like, it started as a triangle and gradually, like, that was too restrictive for like the body positions that I wanted to use. So it's just sort of like a short onesie with like not the full arms and legs.
And then a ponytail for a flourish. That's kind of triangular.
That's just to have like a little bit of a emotional indicator on the head. So it can be like, you know, like a dog ear sticking up really straight or like laying back if I'm feeling more submissive. It's actually a surprisingly important piece of the character for indicating emotion.
Oh, that's interesting. Is that your biology degree coming in to assist?
My biology degree has actually turned out to be incredibly useful for anatomy, for visualizing it, even though it's like simple cartoons, just visualizing it. If I'm trying to draw the character from a position that I don't necessarily know how to draw and say, I don't want to take reference images and I'm looking, you know, being lazy that day, I can think of, okay, well, you know, like the shoulder girdle would be approximately here and the pelvic girdle would be approximately there. And yeah.
How is quarantine working out for you? I think different people are having very different reactions.
So my reaction, I didn't have much of an adjustment period because I'm normally a shut-in. I've been accustomed to the shut-in lifestyle for a number of years now. So it wasn't a difficult transition for me. I have been struck by the way it seems to be affecting other people, just the way that the current climate, politically, socially, just everything we've been through over the last 4 or so years as a country and in the world, I think has, even to somebody who barely leaves the house, it's really apparent that we've been through something. I've been asked by people how the internet seems different now compared to how it was when I, you know, last was online in a significant way, 7 years ago. And my answer is that people seem gentler. It seems like we've really, really been through something. And that sounds like a crazy thing to say about the internet, but it was a really wild experience to see. It was sort of like this time capsule type thing where, yeah, it seems like people are being much more gentle and caring with each other because we've sort of had a run-in with mortality or with our own fragility as a species. And we're, my hope is that, you know, that it continues in this way and that we continue to be gentler and more caring and kind with each other.
Yeah, you did have this long stretch where you took time away from the internet as well as in person. And that's actually something really common with artists, especially introverted ones. So I'm sure that just the sudden fascination of people with your work, the book Hyperbole and a Half being a number one New York Times bestseller, that just must have been just kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah. I don't think I really realized the extent of how introverted I am until like people were paying attention to me. And then it was just like, oh my goodness, this is scary. I thought that this was not going to be quite as scary as it is. But yeah, it was an absolutely crazy experience. And I think led to some very like uncomfortable existential questions for me. Like I remember during my first book tour, we had unexpected levels of turnout for all the events. And we were like exceeding the capacity for venues. There are like lines of people waiting to talk to me that like wrapped around city blocks. And I remember being like, what on earth is this all about? Like that I don't understand it as a person. Like I can't relate to that view of myself. It made me feel like very, I don't know, comparatively small and insignificant because it seemed so drastically disproportionate of a reaction to have to me. It still feels, you know, like I go 7 years between books. It was hard the last time. This time it's like relearning all over again how to exist in the world.
Well, you seem to have picked up on the fact that what attracts people is this just brutal honesty that you're putting out there, where so many people are not being honest or putting on masks, and just how open you are about your struggles. You know, people really are thirsty for something that speaks to the difficulty of being human and being in society.
It's a wild ride being human. I find myself having these feelings, like something I've been trying to write about recently is like the frustrating intangibility of like beautiful things. Like I'll go on these walks in the evenings and see something that it just feels like too beautiful to interact with in any meaningful way, I could try to take a picture of it. I could try to write a poem about it. I could try any number of ways to capture these experiences in some like timeless format. I think it's what drives me to do art in the first place. But I always feel separate from it. Regardless of how close I get, I feel like I can get closer, and it's satisfying to feel like I'm approaching these things, but very difficult to actually interact with a sunset in a meaningful way.
Well, a lot of your stories look deceptively simple, and there's obviously a lot of craft that's gone into that. Do you have influences that people might not expect, like maybe literary influences, storytelling influences, comedy influences?
Okay, so unexpected ones. Let's see. So horror writing actually, I think, taught me a lot about comedy. Jokes work, certain types of jokes, I guess, work the best when you have very strong foreshadowing. And that is extremely present in horror. So I learned a lot from Stephen King. I don't know, I went through this phase, like a very dark phase when I was like 12 and 13, where I wanted to go lay out in the sunshine and read horror books. I liked the emotional juxtaposition. And so Stephen King would be an influence that would probably be surprising for a lot of people. My favorite poet is E.E. Cummings. I think I learned some important things from E.E. Cummings on, you know, it's on the surface. Oh, this is just nonsense. It's commentary on how random things are. But I don't think that's the case. I think that there's a very particular structure to his poetry that, you know, he puts clues in, like there's line breaks, there's punctuation, there's a spatial sense to the poetry, the sense of spatial information, the way that there's one line break and then suddenly there's like three line breaks and a new line. And it's, oh my goodness, that's an actual pause. Like your eyes take longer to go over that gap. Goodness. So somebody I've been studying comedically is Dave Chappelle. I very, very greatly admire what he has done recently. He did a flurry of specials between like 2016 and 2017 and 2019, something like that.
He's gone deep into how broken our society can get in a way that goes back to Bill Hicks and George Carlin.
Yes, it definitely, the commentary is on the level of truly brilliant. I think that Dave Chappelle will go down in history as one of the greatest stand-up comedians of all time. I don't know, I got so much from the way he was able to critique, it's a very sort of like innocent critique in a way. There's not, the whole time on stage, you never get the sense that he is being jaded or cynical, despite the cynical things he's saying. He always keeps an element of levity in there. And I think that's a balance that I'm often trying to strike. And I've watched his specials so many times, just trying to like how is he doing it? Like, what's the ingredient that like makes this feel this balanced way? Because he says some things that would like nobody else could say. And some of the specials where it's like, oh my God, he's actually saying that out loud. Like, because of the like, tonal context, he builds the context to be able to say it. And I very much admire that. An artist that I've learned a lot from is he's a Swedish painter named Simon Stålenhag. I don't know how you pronounce it, but he does these beautiful like post-apocalyptic paintings that he makes books out of them and writes the stories to go with the paintings. So it's actually not an exact format like mine, but it's a similar like stories and pictures, like words and pictures, sort of like a graphic novel. And I've learned a lot about art from zooming in on his paintings and looking at the brush strokes, you know, how he creates a blur effect, how he creates the effect of like raindrops on glass, how you make a street lamp look like a street lamp. What colors do you use? How do you get the, you know, that weird like orange glow around the inside of the bulb? A lot of analysis of his paintings. So maybe that's my list of influences.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And I'm talking today with comics artist and storyteller Ali Brosh. She's the author of the books Solutions and Other Problems and Hyperbole and a Half, Unfortunate Situations, Flawed Coping Mechanisms, Mayhem, and Other Things That Happened. Now, one of the longer stories in your book, Solutions and Other Problems, is called Losing. And it's really a monsoon of a story. I mean, you start out right away just, you're diving into the absurdity of existence. You're laying out everything about this mystery illness that you have, your deteriorating health. You've got this brush with mortality that's giving you a pull towards nihilism. And then, you know, in quick succession, you spin from getting surgery right into the publicity tour for your first book, and then your need to be alone afterwards for the holidays. And that's when you hear the news about your sister.
Yeah, it was, I remember everything about that moment, you know, those moments where it's so traumatic that your brain takes a crystal clear picture of it.
Yeah. That had to be just like the walls were all falling down at once.
Yeah, my husband at the time, who's now my ex-husband, wonderful person still, but my phone was dead, so my mom couldn't get a hold of me. And so she called him. And I remember just by the tone in his voice and the way his face looked when he was handing the phone to me, I knew something was going wrong. Something really bad had happened.
And in some strange way, during the mourning process, you step into the role of the strong member of the family.
I don't know whether I needed to do that, but I think that there's something about, like, however my brain is set up, when things are going very badly, I feel like I have to, like, I don't know. I learned most of my social skills from wolves. I greatly admired wolves as a child, and so I think I internalized some of their social values, and I think I call it wolf mode in my own head. But I go into this, like, all right, just stoic, like, gotta do the best I can to reel it in and be strong for everybody. And the tragedy is that I'm not a very strong person. Naturally, I have those values. I have the part of me that tells me I should be like this, but it's more difficult for me than I think for a lot of people. I'm quite sensitive. So after I heard the news about my sister, I actually couldn't cry for weeks. I clammed up inside and I went, like, totally numb and got paralyzed emotionally. And at the funeral, I was finally able to cry, and it came out, you know, really, really strong, to the point where I think I mentioned in the book, a family friend approached us after the funeral and, you know, was gently suggesting that I try this herbal supplement that he had good luck with, because my emotional outburst seemed too intense for my sister's funeral.
Yeah. Grief is a strange beast. you know, you're comforting your parents. These were the same parents who you so often bewildered as a child.
Yes. And continue to bewilder to this day, occasionally.
You and your sister were, you sort of reflected on this later. You were both kind of bewildering as children in similar ways.
She was a little bit quieter than me, a little bit more reserved. But her chaos came out in different ways. Like, it came out later. I think that she hit her chaotic period later in life than I did. But yeah, we were both little hellions in our own ways.
This seems like a perfectly good time to let listeners know that the number for the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 800-273-TALK. And sometime in the next couple of years, it'll simply be 988. But for now, it's still 800-273-8255. You know, I've talked to some of the people who've worked these hotlines, and they know that the scariest thing that you can hear from a caller is, I just want the pain to stop.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the point at which the person has started to come up with a logical justification for going through with the plan. And that's the, at least in my experience, that's where it starts seeming really scary to me. I know if it's starting to feel like, oh, I'm thinking of like reasons that this would be a good idea. That's typically the time where it's like, yeah, I should probably call somebody or do something about this. It can be hard to tell if you struggle with depression or suicidal ideation. I know that I've had a difficult time differentiating between what is just, oh, I'm depressed, and, you know, casually having suicidal thoughts as like a self-defense mechanism against the feeling of powerlessness, or when is this something that is actually a threat to me? Now that my tell is when the logical justifications start coming in. That's when, I don't know if it would be a tell for everybody, but that's mine.
In Hyperbole and a Half, you have this narrative arc, and it runs through, the first chapter is Adventures in Depression, or Depression Part One. And you talk about how your depression got so horrible that it actually broke through to the other side and became a sort of fear-proof exoskeleton.
Yeah, or so I thought. It was the numbness. It was the impending numbness at the time. But it was a pretty major moment. I mean, I mentioned a few minutes ago that I'm a very sensitive person, and I've always seen that as a handicap of sorts, something that I have been trying to overcome, and in a very real way, trying to get over having feelings. And the numbness or anhedonia of my depression felt like that, like felt like I had finally succeeded. I don't have feelings anymore. And very, very soon afterwards, I discovered that feelings are the things that make life interesting. When you don't have them, things feel very boring and very intangible.
Right. It was a superpower for one hot moment. And then, so in Depression Part Two, the numbness becomes overwhelming and you're surrounded by well-meaning people who have no real concept of what you're going through. And all of them are trying to bright side the situation.
Yes. And I obviously appreciate the effort, but it can be a bit, I think exhausting is the word when you've reached that far gone state where you are suffering from anhedonia and just feeling like overwhelmed by everything. And like, it takes a Herculean amount of effort to even just like do anything other than just stare at a wall. People can recognize that there's something going on with you that maybe you're not feeling your best and they want to help. And so they suggest, you know, oh, have you ever thought about doing this like exercise yoga class at 7 a.m. with me, or start offering solutions to the problem you're having. And it's exhausting to be able to say like, look, I know you mean well, but this isn't the kind of thing that I can do right now. I agree it's helpful to get out and exercise, but you know, 7 a.m. yoga that's never going to be my thing. That's like telling a person who is learning how to walk again, like, oh, well, you know, have you ever tried marathons? It's maybe in a long time, but like, right, like, let's start easy. Let's start from something that I can relate to. Like, have you ever tried going for a walk around the block at 2 a.m. whenever you feel like you have a little tiny surge of motivation, being like, you know what, I could stand to see some streetlights about now. Like, maybe that's the exercise program that I could have related to at the time.
I do want to encourage people to actually read the stories. These are in Hyperbole and a Half, either the book or the webcomic online, because I don't want to give the impression that these are just dolorous stories here. There's all this humor and absurdity leaking out. And part of where the absurdity breaks through in Depression Part Two is where you are down on the floor in the kitchen and you discover a shriveled kernel of corn underneath the refrigerator.
Yeah, when I saw the piece of corn, it hit a nerve and I had a laughing fit that is possibly even to this day the strongest laughing fit I've ever had. It was genuinely scary, the type where you can't breathe and you're incapacitated. I think in the years since, I've tried to figure out what it was about this piece of corn alone in a vast expanse of floor that caused me to laugh so hard. And I think it was because I related to it. It felt like an exact representation of the feelings I was going through at the time. And yeah, that's like the type of humor that I have a list somewhere of things that I found unusually funny. And I think this is when I started realizing why I laughed at the corn and what led to writing the intro to Solutions and Other Problems, which is about a balloon that I saw tied to a truck going 90 miles an hour.
Oh, I was going to recommend that you might read that story from the beginning of Solutions and Other Problems.
Oh, yeah. Oh, let me do that first, because that actually would be a good setup for the list.
Okay.
I saw a balloon going 90 miles per hour. It was tied to a truck, so there was an explanation for it, but I don't know. I guess you still just never expect to see a balloon going that fast. Balloons aren't designed for that. They aren't aerodynamic enough. This one was wobbling all around in spastic little circles, making a sound like whoop, 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 whoop. It seemed genuinely out of control. I was laughing so hard I had to pull over. I feel just like that balloon. And so that's one of the items on my list of funny things that I've seen. And the others are, there was a potato mixed in with like the lemons in the grocery store. Like somebody had a potato and they just set it there. But things like the inanimate objects in situations I relate to, that's like the thing that makes me laugh the hardest.
Whenever I would be assigned to read a Franz Kafka story, or I'd go to see a Ingmar Bergman film, I felt like I was the only person laughing.
I do relate to that, because I feel like there's absurdity in things that are incredibly detailed. Like when you see something that is true and detailed, it in a similar way to like why I laugh at, you know, pieces of corn and balloons and potatoes and with the lemons. I think it's a similar kind of joke where you're seeing the reality of something and what it communicates with like context and all of the other information is quite funny and hits the part of me that is like a helpless animal that relates to it, that relates to the like ennui or the drama or the even like the bleakness in a way. Yeah, I definitely think stuff in that wheelhouse can be quite humorous.
Well, there's a self-awareness to the bleakness.
Yeah. It's presented in a way that like I can connect to, rather than like, oh, this is bleak and hopeless and horrible. It's like bleak, but it's in just an off enough way that, yeah, you can, yeah, it's bleak, but bleakness can be funny.
A lot of your most popular stories are about the randomness of children. And your own stories of doing random things. People might forget these or repress them. And you have all these stories from when you're 2, 3, 4 years old and just insisting on doing these, engaging in these very odd activities.
I don't know where the impulse comes from. Maybe it's curiosity. Maybe I just want to see what's going to happen. But I've always had a drive to just do strange things, or what I've learned are strange things. Like my parents didn't want us to grow up watching TV. Like my grandma had a TV and we'd sometimes sneak over there and watch hers, but we didn't really have a lot of that stuff. We just grew up out in the sticks. running around. One of my favorite hobbies was trying to sneak up on deer.
You really were paying attention to the wolves.
Yes. I did learn a lot of social cues from animals. I had friends, obviously, but I spent a lot of time alone in the forest, and my development was not allowed to be influenced by things like what people think of me. And it was actually very difficult for me when I started realizing, like, oh my God, I'm a weirdo, because I am a weirdo, and I have strange preferences. I have the desire to do weird things. I find myself in the position of explaining a lot because the things I'm doing are so strange that they require explanation to onlookers.
There's a story that you did early on about your childhood called Menace.
Yes.
It's fascinating because it kind of touches on the whole idea of masks and personas. And in this story, you're only 4 years old, but you've got a dinosaur costume. And somehow every time, it starts out in Halloween, but it goes onward from there because you discover that every time you put on this dinosaur costume, you kind of turn into a dinosaur.
It felt like my like superhero power, being inside this costume. I felt powerful. And so power is a big theme in a lot of the stuff I do, and particularly in Solutions and Other Problems. But this was sort of like an early exploration of that, of like what your limitations seem like when you feel powerful versus when you don't. And when I was wearing this dinosaur costume, I felt incredibly powerful, and it made me feel like, oh, well, you know, as a human child, I'm not supposed to take these crayons and scribble all over the wall and then throw them at my teacher when she tries to get them away from me. But as a dinosaur, maybe that's on the table now. I can do those kinds of things as a dinosaur. And even the punishments seemed different as a dinosaur. They felt like they weren't directed at me. They were directed at this dinosaur, and it spiraled out of control. And I would put on the costume just recreationally after Halloween. It took my parents a while to figure out what was going on, though, because the explanation that the teacher had given them for why I was flipping out was, oh, it was probably the Halloween candy. You know, kids these days, like, they can't handle sugar. And so they were under the impression that the problem was sugar. So whenever I would be flipping out, they'd be like, oh, you know, she must have gotten into the candy. And I started actually trying to do that, because one of the things that I want to do when I'm feeling extremely powerful is resist things that are trying to stop me. And so I would go in and get into the, I think the grenadine syrup was something that they found me with, a just drinking grenadine syrup straight out of the bottle. And so it took them quite a while to figure out that it was the dinosaur costume causing these outbursts, or possibly just me and my relationship to the dinosaur costume.
And one of the ways in which you're trying to kind of come to terms with power and fear and restraint and all, there's a story called The Ultimate Plan, where you try to cure your fears with psychedelic drugs.
Yes. So the plan was to figure out something I could do, like a training plan that I could do to once and for all eradicate fear, which, you know, I learned that maybe I shouldn't get rid of all of my feelings from depression, but maybe we could just focus on fear. Maybe we could like just cut this one out. And so the idea was to, at first the idea was to do like a gradual plan, like a, you know, fear reps, I think is the term I used. But it seemed like that was too slow of a plan. I was getting impatient. I was still feeling weak and scared all the time. And so I had the idea of stranding myself outdoors, taking a huge amount of hallucinogenic drugs, and seeing if maybe I could just scare it out of myself, just face all the things that I am afraid of all at once and just get to the other side of it, process it, and done. Didn't quite end up working like that. But I mean, maybe I feel a little braver. I don't know.
Well, one thing that people talk about in drug therapy with hallucinogens like LSD and psilocybin and ketamine is that they feel more of a sense of connection with other people and well-being. Like there's something out there in the universe, a collective unconscious or whatever, that's keeping us safe or giving us some spark.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, it feels, I feel more like a sense of acceptance. Like I've had like profound experiences of acceptance on hallucinogenic drugs that I haven't had elsewhere. I mean, I've had versions of them. I suppose that there's times where I'm like extremely stressed and, you know, that like eye of the storm feeling when you're going through something really, really difficult and there's that little break in it where it's just like, okay, you know, you kind of come into the present moment and realize where you are and it feels like incredibly beautiful in contrast to the chaos around it. It feels like a different version of that. I remember specifically one time laying on the dirt, face down on the dirt, almost like hugging the ground and feeling just totally at peace with having dirt on my face and in my hair, and I could feel the sun on my back, and it felt so amazing that I did not care that I was like laying on the dirt and weeds and sticks and bugs and all of that. Another aspect of drugs that I found incredibly useful as it relates to mental health is practicing dealing with feelings, different types of feelings. Like I think experiences I had on drugs have turned out to be very useful in talking myself out of the types of mental states I get into when like depressed or anxious or anything like that, because it's all just feelings, right? It's all just chemicals in your brain, and you can reason through it in a similar way when you're having a depression trip or a anxiety trip. You know, if you've ever had a bad trip on mushrooms, say, there are strategies you can use to take yourself out of it. Like I always tell myself to look at the sky if I'm having a bad trip. Just whatever you think, it doesn't matter, like look at the sky. It's just like my safe word or whatever that I have with myself for if things start going really out of my control. And that has been incredibly useful for anxiety and depression as well. It's just a little distraction that jolts me out of the whatever train of thought I'm in that's making me feel really bad. It doesn't cure it or anything, but having access to that button has been very useful.
Yeah, in a lot of the stories, your feelings of self-consciousness are just kind of getting in your way. You're always second guessing yourself. And I'm reminded when I read your books, there's a famous line from the William Butler Yeats poem, The Second Coming: the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. And it seems like we're living in a society right now where the most confident people are the hucksters, the financial predators, the oligarchs.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, it's the people that are really sincere that are always second guessing themselves.
I think that it's, you know, part of when you're a sensitive person who has like that sense of empathy or whatever, it's part of your like value system to care how you come across. You know, I've spent a lot of time trying to become more like James Bond, more like, you know, one of those people who doesn't care about anything. One of those glorified sociopaths who it seems like has their shit together. That has always seemed like the thing that I want to be. And I think in recent years, I've been realizing that that's maybe not the optimal type of person to be. You know, why are we looking to sociopaths for just to somebody who doesn't have feelings as like an example of, oh, this is a really cool person? I feel like caring needs to be cool again. And I'm trying to do my part for myself to like explain to myself why I don't necessarily need to be an unfeeling badass. Because I feel like when you have that as your value, if you're just trying to like assert your identity in the world without regard to how it impacts others, you end up like the overly confident but harmful type of person. And because it's not really a two-way street with sociopaths. I don't want to be like that, and so I think that I have a much more strong desire to fact check and, you know, do quality control on my behavior and the way I'm interacting with the world. I'm always trying to analyze how it's coming across. You know, am I being alienating? Am I how am I affecting people? How do they like me? Do they think I'm too weird? All that kind of stuff.
I remember hearing a neuropsych talking about Star Trek, and he said that Star Trek is wrong about saying that Mr. Spock's lack of emotion makes him a better decision maker. He says, it's our emotions that make us better decision makers.
They're a sense. I very strongly feel that emotions are a sense, a physical sense that you have, like, to sense your environment, to sense your social and emotional environment. And that when you do not have emotions, you lack, it's like being blind emotionally. You know, maybe emotions can be too strong, like they can get in the way if you aren't treating them as information and treating them as, you know, this is the reality of the situation. You know, this isn't just a piece of the puzzle. This is the reality of the world is that I'm sad right now. You know, the reality is that I'm feeling sad, and that's a very useful piece of information about my environment, about my life, about what I might need to do to move in a different direction.
I think the power of your comics, of your books, is that I think a lot of writers, a lot of artists would say, well, this incident that I've experienced is just too out there, and I'm just going to put it aside because it's silly to try to share it with people and try to get them to relate. And you just go for it. You put something out there and you insist, look, can you relate to this? And that there's a power in that.
I mean, I noticed somewhat early on that people seemed to be relating to the things I was writing, despite, like, I made some attempts to be like, all right, this one they surely will not relate to. This will prove to them once and for all that I am the weirdo that I am claiming to be. And there will be people who can relate to this. So far, I have found that to be untrue. Sometimes it's fewer people than, you know, others, but there's usually at least one person that's like, you know, I've experienced a version of that. And it might not be exactly the same thing, but it's very therapeutic for me to have that kind of connection with, you know, even some person I'm never going to meet that's just like in the comments on Reddit, or whether or not it's my like professional work. I do a lot of like secret commenting on Reddit where I'll write my like real, real weird things. And there's usually at least one person that's like, I get that. It's incredibly heartening.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Kauncer. And my guest today has been comics artist and storyteller Ali Brosh, author of the books Solutions and Other Problems and Hyperbole and a Half, Unfortunate Situations, Flawed Coping Mechanisms, Mayhem, and Other Things That Happened. Ali, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you today.
It's been a pleasure talking with you too, Con.
Now, for our listeners who might be interested in your various projects, how can they find out more? Where can they go?
Oh, goodness. So Googling Solutions and Other Problems will probably take you to my book. I am on Instagram as of recently. It's ALLIE_BROSH is, I believe that's my Instagram handle. Facebook, it's at Real Hyperbole and a Half, I believe. Or if you Google Hyperbole and a Half Facebook, that's how you find me on there.
And you're posting again. Your fans are happy.
I am posting on Facebook. I've been doing a photo album that chronicles the last 7 years. And it's been a very fun project. It's taken off in some unexpected directions.
Well, thanks again. And thanks also to our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. And a very special thanks to Ken Jones for his expert work engineering today's program. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at wordsandpicture.